Welcome to the 9th episode of the official SBGAN podcast, hosted by Dr. Alex Nicely.
Welcome to the podcast, everybody. You are in for a treat because you're going to hear from Professor Lorenzo D'Antiga of Bergamo in Italy, a hepatologist whom I met more than 20 years ago when I came to London to King's College Hospital to take up a position as a histopathologist there, and when he was a fellow in pediatric hepatology. We've known each other since then, but seen each other only seldom, and you're not seeing the pictures, you're not on the camera, but I can tell you that not only his CV, not only his position there in Bergamo as a professor, but also his appearance now is completely distinguished. He is silver-haired, and who would have thought it? If anybody's wondering, I'm not silver-haired or distinguished. I'm just fat. Lorenzo, welcome.
Thank you very much, Alex. It is great to see you, really. And I do remember very well the time when we were at King's, and I remember, you know, histopathology meeting with you describing the pathology, histopathology of the patients we were looking after. It was really great. So it is really a privilege to have you to be interviewed by today.
In case anybody believes him, not even my mother would believe that. But thank you anyhow. Now, what you've done, let me describe a little bit for the audience how this works. We choose somebody like you, who has something to say. And your CV shows that you've had the knack of being in the right place to take part in an awful lot of interesting work in a lot of different aspects of pediatric gastroenterology and pediatric hepatology. How do you choose what to ask an expert about when he's an expert in so many areas? Good question. So what we do is we let the experts themselves choose what they'd like to talk about. And Lorenzo has provided three publications, one about screening pediatric patients with cholestasis for genetic disorders, and two with aspects of diagnosis of biliary tract disease using liver biopsy. Which is to say that he's wandered into my cage and I'm hungry.
You know, Alex, you were one of the persons who made me, you know, appreciate and love histopathology, actually. I say that I cannot take care of a child with liver disease without looking at the liver of that patient. But so it's so great, and I'm so fond of histopathology. But now I'm a little bit concerned because I realized I really stepped into your field, and let's see how it goes.
Let's see how it goes. Well, folks, for those reading along at home, the two biliary tract disorder papers, one is Yep, okay. One of them is first author DiGiorgio, Biliary Features in Liver Histology of Children with Autoimmune Liver Disease. This is a subject that right at the moment is really dear to my heart. And it's dear to my heart because often and often I receive biopsy specimens from kids who have low titers of autoantibodies, grumbling transaminases, and some features, but not a lot, in biomarker work of biliary tract disease. Now, the two things that I place real reliance on in saying maybe this is going to be a biliary tract disorder, maybe this is going to be an autoimmune sclerosing cholangitis or an overlap rather than an autoimmune hepatitis, are serum bile acids, quantitative, and gamma-glutamyl transpeptidase. So I am fascinated to see that neither of these is one of the biomarkers that you elected to evaluate here. That is, if I've remembered this correctly. Tell me about how you chose your patients in this study. No, I tell a lie. I tell a lie. Gamma GT is involved here, but bile acids are not. Speak to us about bile acids and their serum bile acids and their value in this particular setting, please.
Okay. Okay, Alex. So thank you for describing a little bit this this paper, which is mainly in autoimmune liver disease. So we reviewed retrospectively 41 patients who had autoimmune hepatitis or autoimmune sclerosing cholangitis. That was the final diagnosis. We went back to see all the histology we did. You know, as I told you, we are very fond of histology, so we do follow-up biopsies in these patients. Every 3 years, we repeat a biopsy. Because what we wanted to see is basically the liver involvement, the biliary, actually, involvement in these liver disorders. So, as you were saying, many autoimmune liver diseases in children actually overlap between autoimmune hepatitis and autoimmune sclerosing cholangitis, but or better, autoimmune hepatitis and sclerosing cholangitis. And for this reason, we suggest that all patients should have a cholangiography to make the diagnosis. But the cholangiograms we have at the moment, which is a magnetic resonance cholangiogram, are not so sensible. So probably they pick up, let's say, a shift towards a biliary disease quite late. So we wanted to see what was the histological biliary involvement in these patients, both in autoimmune and hepatitis and in sclerosing cholangitis. So obviously the bile acid and gamma GT were taken into account. But what was very important is the biliary features at histology, because, you know, one of the issues is that probably in children, sclerosing cholangitis starts very slowly and sometimes moves from autoimmune hepatitis. And also there is a biliary disease in adults, a type of sclerosing cholangitis, which is called small duct BSC, which is an histological diagnosis. So this is why we thought that in children, biliary involvement in autoimmune liver disease might be, you know, seen earlier in histology rather than in cholangiography. So this is the focus of the paper, and in fact, what we saw is that even patients with autoimmune hepatitis diagnosed and confirmed over a long follow-up have some biliary features on histology. Obviously, you have to stain with cytokeratin to see that. But this paper is focused on that. And what is good, I believe, is that we also prepared a new score, which somehow proceeds from another score for PSC. And we have somehow validated a score for biliary features in this setting, which was not there before. So the findings, I think, interesting findings are that even patients with autoimmune hepatitis have biliary features in their liver histology, although patients with sclerosing cholangitis or autoimmune sclerosing cholangitis have a little bit more prominent biliary features, and in particular, they are distinguished by the presence of some periductular fibrosis. But this is the only, you know, distinctive features of autoimmune sclerosing cholangitis, because even autoimmune hepatitis have all the other biliary abnormalities. What do you think?
What do I think? Well, I think that I'm used to seeing biliary features in any kind of hepatitis. I'm used to seeing biliary features whenever an infiltrate in the portal tract spills out into the lobule with activity at the limiting plate and damages hepatocytes. My impression is that hepatocytes seek refuge in becoming cholangiocytes. It's as if I pretend I'm a cholangiocyte, then they can't hurt me. And so with any kind of hepatitis, if I look with cytokeratin 7, whether it's autoimmune, whether it's viral, whether it's toxic, I see some degree of ductular reaction. So that my touchstone, and a touchstone that is not used in your manuscript, in your paper, is the presence of deposits of copper or of copper-binding protein. And if I had this manuscript to do over, I would say, let's go back and take a look at, we can restain the H&E, we can restain anything we like. Let's see how many of the autoimmune hepatitis with ductular proliferation also have deposits of copper-binding protein. Because impaired choleresis with impaired copper secretion excretion is a bona fide, surefire thing, in my opinion, when it comes to biliary tract disease. Over to you.
That's interesting. We certainly can do that. You know this very well. You have to consider that these patients, although they have biliary features, often some biliary involvement and sometimes biliary tract disease, they're not very cholestatic actually. So I wonder, you know, if these patients are on ursodeoxycholic acid usually, but they're not very cholestatic. So I wonder whether really the copper will come significant, because even when the disease is prominently biliary, cholestasis is not particularly, you know.
You're my best friend. I have to tell you this because sometimes the gamma GT may be slightly elevated. Okay, fair enough. Bile acids may be slightly elevated. Okay, fair enough. But for me, it's when you see a little peppering of copper binding protein, and I rely on an Orsian or a Victoria Blue because rhodanine just isn't sensitive enough, then I say, all right, guys, this is the real thing. This is a cholangiopathy. Sometimes you don't see that peribiliary fibrosis. Sometimes you see it only very focally. The autoimmune sclerosing cholangitides, the small duct diseases, aren't evenly distributed throughout the liver, at least when it comes to biopsy. So I'm an Orsian or Victoria Blue copper-binding protein metallothionein guy. Back to you.
It's great. I understand you know this paper caught your interest somehow, and I'm happy to see that you agree that in these diseases there is a biliary involvement. There are biliary features. So I wonder whether you agree that it is important to focus more on histology of autoimmune liver disorders rather than relying only on cholangiography to define it, because all the details you were talking about probably can give us hints to understand the natural history of sclerosing cholangitis that in children often moves from a more florid, disease, autoimmune hepatitis, then autoimmune sclerosing cholangitis.
What you've just asked me is, Alex, do you love your wife? Do you love your kids? Do you think that histopathology has a greater role to play? Yes! Okay. Get that needle out, guys.
All right.
Okay, let's move on to the next biliary paper, okay? Yeah. Well, that was fun, at least for me. Okay, closing that one and heading out to the next biliary paper. Where were we? Go forward. Okay. Yeah. This would be, I think, by Sansotta. A brief communication. Subclinical biliary strictures, as a cause of long-term allograft dysfunction in children who underwent liver transplantation. As a cause of long-term allograft dysfunction. That's a big old claim. This appeared in, where do I find the reference? There we go.
It's American Journal of Transplantation.
What's the take-home message from this work, please?
I think the take-home message is, the pediatric liver transplantation community is very much focused on long-term allograft dysfunction in the last years, and probably the long-term allograft dysfunction due to subclinical biliary strictures has been, underscored. The message is biliary strictures in the long term might be the main cause of long-term allograft dysfunction and loss in pediatric liver transplantation.
I think that's important. When I was at King's, and since then, my focus has been mostly on fibrosis or on persistence of inflammation, inflammation with features that suggest ongoing cellular rejection in follow-up allograft biopsy specimens. And if I've seen a little bit of bile duct proliferation, then following my biases, the ones that I outlined for you a few moments ago, I've said, well, there probably was a rejection-associated hepatitis going on here, and it's left us with some biliary-type ductular reaction that isn't all that important. Now, mind you, because all my biopsy specimens are stained for copper-binding protein, when I see copper-binding protein, then I say, hey, there's something going on here. This needs to be tracked and traced. But the idea of associating this with a distal biliary tract stricture, okay, I haven't been suggesting that yet, and maybe I should.
Yeah, the point is exactly what you're highlighting. The focus has been mainly on hepatitis and fibrosis in the long term. But the experience tells us that we lose many organs, many livers, from a biliary problem. And you know, we transplant children with left lateral segment, and these grafts have, a little bit difficult anatomical reconstruction of the biliary tract, because they have they don't have an end-to-end anastomosis, but they have a real loop. So many of these grafts have some impairment in the biliary excretion. And as we were saying, we are so fond of histology that we do follow-up biopsies, and we like the biliary patterns. So what we do actually is not looking at the clinical signs of biliary obstruction, not only. You know, many centers rely on the dilatation of the bile duct at ultrasound. But that is tends to be a late event, because these livers are stiff, so they don't dilate much, even if there is some problem with the outflow, with the biliary outflow. So what we do is looking at biliary proliferation as a marker of stricture. So what we did here is reviewing our experience, and our experience, follows a protocol based on biliary proliferation as an indication to do a percutaneous transhepatic cholangiogram. So we do PTCs in all patients having a clear ductular proliferation in these patients, in these grafts. And what we found is that this is the best way of diagnosis as subclinical stricture. Actually, nearly half of these patients did not have any dilatation of the biliary tree, but they did have a stricture at cholangiography. So we believe that this is a very important aspect of subclinical slow allograft dysfunction in the long term for these patients.
I'm going to turn to the biomarkers here. You have a plot of gamma GT and serum bile acids as potentially significant in these kids.
Yeah. But what we found, curiously, the best marker, the best predictor of biliary stricture was alkaline phosphatase. You know, we don't use this very much in children, because we know that alkaline phosphatase is synthesized from the bones, and a large part in children. But actually in these patients, a level of alkaline phosphatase greater than 325 had a high sensitivity, and actually 86% for as a positive predictive value to diagnose a biliary stricture.
I'm going to regret out loud again that there's no use of metallothionein staining here, because I think that it's always a good thing to have more than one marker, such as cytokeratin 7 expression and copper-binding protein deposition, when attempting to reach a conclusion as to whether the findings are pointing in the same direction. To have those two markers pointing in the same direction gives me greater confidence in saying something biliary is going on here than does only one. Well, that's not quite true. If I find copper-binding protein there, I say, hey, this is what's going on. Nonetheless, so again, if I'd been a reviewer here, I'd have said, hey, go back and do another stain. Do another stain. But this is lovely work and important work. And what kind of resonance has it found among the transplantation community? Are people picking up this observation and running with it?
I think talking to the other centers, they're quite in agreement on the fact that we lose many grafts from a biliary problem. So the end of the story is common in many centers. So I think there is quite wide agreement on the fact that biliary problems are relevant in these patients. Although probably we are the only one having this, if you want, quite invasive approach. We proceed from the biopsy and we go straight to the PTC. But the end of the story is agreed. Many livers in pediatric recipients are lost due to a biliary problem.
So you've got a diagnosis now of a biliary problem. And you've got a prognosis, which is this liver is not going to do well. Have you got an intervention?
Yeah, of course. The intervention is by balloon bilioplasty that we do. But that's commonly done everywhere. You know, the point is that it might be diagnosed differently, but then the treatment is the same. So you get into the biliary tree with PTC, you dilate with a balloon, you leave a tube inside. You might use stents. Nowadays there are also biodegradable stents that last for 2 months, and we're using those. So the treatment is bilioplasty, and then if there is recurrence, at the end the treatment becomes surgical, so a redo of the biliary anastomosis.
Has your approach, that of relatively more invasive diagnosis and potentially earlier diagnosis of these complications, made a difference to your allograft survival rate compared with that in other institutions? Or is the jury still out?
This is an important question, but we don't have this comparison so far. We believe we're saving many, many livers, but we don't have this comparison. Certainly we have a good graft survival in the long term, but it is difficult now to, you know, it is not so easy to compare two different institutions having a different approach. We believe it is very important to be aggressive on the biliary problems and the biliary strictures, but I should say that I don't have a strong marker saying, yeah, definitely we are having a better survival in the long term compared to other centers. And I believe it is difficult. You know, for instance, many centers do living related, some others do cadaveric disease donor liver transplant, or they do more. Some still do the reduced livers, which have a different, less problems with the biliary tree because you have more liver on your side. So we believe this is important. We demonstrated that it's the pathological evaluation of biliary features is in keeping with the subclinical stricture. But I cannot say that we have strong evidence that this is providing although it is quite logical to think to have a better outcome compared to other centers.
I'm sure you're collecting those data, and I look forward one day to seeing them presented.
Yeah.
We have, well, we've been in the playgrounds of the Lord, that of histopathology, for quite a little while now, and maybe it's time to switch to article number 3.
Yeah, I'm more relaxed about that because it's not very histopathology-based, so maybe.
Oh, you are so wrong. You are so wrong.
Okay.
All right. This one
Let's
made it into...
Okay.
This one is in Journal
of PDA. But don't tell me you want copper-binding proteins here as well, please.
You've got the best you've got wonderful histopathologists there, and if...
Yeah, we do.
And I'm sure that they're using it when they find it appropriate.
Yeah.
Now, in Journal of Pediatrics, not too long ago, 2019, you presented the diagnostic yield of an algorithm for neonatal and infantile cholestasis integrating next-generation sequencing. Dr. Nicastro is the first author. Whoa. Well, I like the fact that you were able, using this approach. Well, let me be fair to you. Why don't you sketch your approach, present it in a few words, and then we'll talk about why you used that particular approach. Over to you.
Yeah. Yeah. You know better than me that since, let's say, 2-3 decades ago, the most common diagnosis of in liver, pediatric hepatology was neonatal idiopathic hepatitis. That was a diagnosis which was descriptive. You know, these patients had giant cell hepatitis. We didn't know what were the causes. Some would improve eventually, some others would not over time. But that was a diagnosis, a big group of patients without a diagnosis, just descriptive. Over time, we discovered several diseases presenting at neonatal or infantile age with cholestasis. And many of those were genetic disorders. So we now know that there are several diseases that causes neonatal infantile cholestasis. We know that bilirubinuria is the most common, but probably we have tools to distinguish that without very 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 sophisticated testing. But then the other group of patients can be, characterized now better through the genetic testing. Nonetheless, since, let's say, 5-10 years back, genetic testing was a little bit, limited, because with a Sanger technique, you could just target one gene, one mutation. So it was quite tricky to have a wide evaluation of the genome or the exome. And then this tool came up, the next generation sequencing. With this tool, you can sequence the whole exome or the whole genome in one night. And that's very powerful sequencing technique. So the problem now is using this technique properly in the correct settings. And so this paper focuses of introducing next generation sequencing in the algorithm we have already for neonatal cholestasis to characterize quickly genetic disorders and reduce the number of patients with idiopathic neonatal hepatitis.
I think that's valuable. It's certainly valuable. I have a few questions about the leftovers, you might say. You enrolled 125 kids, and 74, or 59%, had biliary atresia. All right, take them away. That leaves you with about 50 kids who underwent genetic testing. Interesting for me is that the biliary atresia kids didn't also undergo genetic testing to see if there is a possible locus minoris resistentiae, a weak spot in their genome somewhere. Be interesting to take a look at that. Now, you found genetic diagnoses in, what would that be, 30 of those patients, 60%? Alagille syndrome in 11, great. PFIC type 2 in 6, alpha-1 antitrypsin storage disorder in 3, and MDR3 disease in 2 with 7 zebras. 18 of 125, 14%, remained with an indeterminate etiology. That's an indeterminate etiology on the basis of genetic studies. Did you pull out any diagnoses in those 18 with the help of histopathology?
Yeah, well, yes. Some of these patients have been diagnosed eventually, both on, with histopathology or with biochemical tests. But I think what is important there is the algorithm in the paper, you know, both the algorithm showing where the patients were diagnosed and how through this this new algorithm. But I think what is important to highlight is that this tool is mainly a tool to diagnose genetic disorders that have already been discovered. So what is proposed with NGS is not to use it as a research tool. That can be done, of course, but it's much more tricky to use it to find new diseases. It is a fantastic tool to diagnose rapidly all the conditions that have already been described, because this is just a way of sequencing, for instance, the whole exome, which is the part of the genome encoding for proteins, and looking at all the diseases that have already been described, therefore that are in the databases. So as soon as a new disease is discovered, you can find it, even retrospectively if you have sequenced the whole exome. So this is a tool for a rapid diagnosis of diseases already described, first of all. This is why it can be standardized easily.
I'm not questioning that, Lorenzo. Not at all. Yeah. That's absolutely the case. What I hope to lay the groundwork for in my questioning is the proposal that not to do a liver biopsy and to say, we'll just squeeze the kid and look at the juice.
Yeah.
May not be the answer. That you have to come at a diagnosis from multiple approaches, and that, for example, PFIC2, when you immunostain for bile salt export pump expression, well, you can get a diagnosis, you can confirm a genetic diagnosis there, or even suggest a diagnosis, such as, FXR1 deficiency, or BSEP deficiency, ABCB11 disease, before the genetic results come back. You did biopsies in all these kids, yes?
Not all of these patients, because the idea is to avoid the liver biopsies in some patients. So the algorithm proceeds and then starts from the color of the stool. If the stool is not colored, is hypocolic or colic, the patient is suspected to have bilirubinuria, and these patients do have a biopsy. The other patients have genetic testing. So one of the the messages here is that you can actually avoid a biopsy using NGS in the algorithm, although many patients eventually will have liver biopsy if they're
not
diagnosed.
You're my best friend anymore. I'd really
I try to get away from, you know, from your field a bit.
Okay. Lorenzo, I could go on, and of course I would go on, but I've looked at the time. And as much as I'd like to continue to badger you, I think it's time to say goodbye.
Yeah. Yeah, it probably is, but it is really, it's been a great pleasure to discuss with you these papers, and thank you for highlighting the main points of these papers coming from the Bergamo Center. Really, thank you.
We haven't had a chance to touch on some things that I'd like to. We won't have the chance to touch on some things that I'd like to, but we cannot leave without asking you for something from Bergamo, something from Italy, maybe a song that, maybe a song that you'd like to share with international listeners. Which song have you chosen for us as being particularly meaningful, memorable to you as part of Italy?
I chose a song from a great author who used to play the guitar, and really he did really great songs. The author is Pino Daniele, and the song is Quando, meaning when.
If you would like to listen to the song, check out our Spotify playlist, Espigan's Favorite Songs.
Lorenzo, thank you very much for the chance to chat. It's been too long. I mean, not just the podcast, but it's been too long since we had a chance to talk about these things.
Thank you very much, Alex. It's been really a great pleasure. And thanks to the Espigan. Goodbye.